Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, as ICE raids ramp up across the country and even here in our backyard, activists are fighting back. We hear from the Dignity.Detention Coalition about a bill that would cut state ties with immigrant detention, including a contract in Orange County. Then some hopeful news in Sullivan County's opioid crisis. Overdose deaths are on the decline, but the work isn't over. Kimberly Izar reports from a local task force meeting about what's next. We'll also spotlight the Victims Intervention Program in Northeast Pennsylvania. Randy Bannon joins us to talk about how VIP is helping survivors of domestic and sexual violence and how you can support their life-saving work. And get ready to sparkle. Drag Me to the Catskills returns to the Forestburg Playhouse this weekend. That's all coming up. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There's been a major airline crash today in western India. An Air India jet headed for London crashed almost immediately after it took off today. Searchers are looking for the 242 people who were aboard. It's feared that everyone aboard has been killed. There may be people on the ground who've also been injured. Local media say the jet crashed into a building that houses medical doctors. Air India says the aircraft was a Boeing 787 Dreamliner. Stocks opened lower this morning after a report showing only mild inflation at the wholesale level. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 150 points in early trading.
Wholesale prices rose less than expected last month. The news comes a day after the government reported equally mild inflation at the retail level. Wholesale prices rose 0.1% between April and May and are up 2.6% over the last year. So far, there's little evidence that President Trump's tariffs are driving prices higher, although forecasters warn that could happen in the months to come. New applications for unemployment benefits held steady last week as about 250,000 people applied for jobless aid. Stock in Boeing is down after that crash of a 787 Dreamliner in India. It comes just days ahead of the Paris Air Show, which is a major sales showcase for Boeing and its European rival, Airbus. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The UN's nuclear watchdog agency has declared Iran is breaching nuclear non-proliferation agreements. NPR's Jana Raff reports Iran has responded. It says it will expand its nuclear program.
Shortly after the International Atomic Energy Agency accused Iran of noncompliance Thursday, Iranian state media said the country in response would build a new uranium enrichment site in a secure location. It was the first time in almost 20 years the UN agency has accused Iran of breaching its non-proliferation obligations. Iran had signed a deal with the U.S. and other major powers 10 years ago, limiting its uranium enrichment program. But President Trump later pulled out of the accord. He said Wednesday that the U.S. would not allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. U.S. and Iranian officials are expected to hold a sixth round of talks Sunday in Oman on Tehran speeding up its uranium enrichment program. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
Los Angeles is quiet as an overnight curfew has expired. It covered 1 square mile of downtown L.A. Some protests against immigration raids in the past few days have been violent. President Trump deployed thousands of U.S. troops to the city. Yesterday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth refused to rule out the possibility that Trump could send the U.S. military to other cities, even if their officials do not want the federal aid. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 120 points. This is NPR. The House is set to vote later this afternoon on a package of $9 billion in spending cuts. The legislation would claw back more than $1 billion in federal funding for public broadcasting. Supporters say that Congress must stop funding public broadcasting they say is biased. Supporters of public media say cuts would hurt those in rural areas who need access to news and emergency alert services. The Hollywood companies Disney and Universal are suing the maker of artificial intelligence images, Midjourney. The companies allege Midjourney is using AI to steal their copyrighted libraries and it's illegally redistributing copies of their characters. These include Darth Vader and Disney princesses. A new South African study finds that dehorning rhinos significantly reduces their poaching. Kate Bartlett has more from Johannesburg.
Tourists traveling to South Africa's national parks might be disappointed to see one of the region's most iconic animals without its famous horn. But researchers say the removal of their horns could be saving their lives. New research in the journal Science found removing the horn, sought after by poachers, reduced the killing of the rhinos by almost 80%, and the process does not hurt the animal, conservationists say. The horn is falsely believed by many in Asia to hold medicinal properties, driving the massive illegal trade. Poaching remains high in South Africa, with over 100 rhinos killed in the first 3 months of this year alone. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As Immigration and Customs Enforcement steps up raids in local communities and protests continue across the country in cities like L.A., Chicago, and New York, some regional activists are pushing for legislation to end all New York State and local contracts with ICE for immigrant detention. In Orange County, the Orange County Correctional Facility has a long-standing contract with ICE to detain immigrants in the state while officers are actively conducting raids on local communities and putting people, including some children, into detainment. Since 2018, the Dignity Not Detention Coalition, a group of various organizations based in New York and New Jersey, have been advocating for the passage of the Dignity Not Detention Act, which, quote, gets New York out of the business of immigration detention, end quote. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke with Dignity Not Detention Coalition members Tanya Matos of Unlocal and Samaz Sissay of the Center for Constitutional Rights. They talked about the bill and about the Orange County Correctional Facility in particular. Here's Tanya Matos.
Issue here is that counties are choosing to collaborate with ICE, and county jails are choosing to opt into contracts with ICE to hold people for immigration. It's really New York State county jails doing the work of ICE and for the federal government in New York State. And so we want to address that issue and pass the legislation which would not allow for county jails to sign into contracts with ICE anymore. It would end the current contracts. There are several contracts in New York State, the biggest one being Orange County Jail, and the other ones are across New York State. We have about six facilities that do collaborate with ICE, but we've seen one more pop up and one more contract be signed in the last, it feels like forever, but the last month or 2 months. And if we don't put a stop to it, ICE detentions will only expand in New York State.
Since 2018, the Dignity Not Detention Coalition, a working group of various organizations based in New York and New Jersey, have been advocating for the passage of this bill. Similar legislation has been able to successfully pass in states such as California, Washington, Illinois, and New Jersey, and numerous New York senators have signed on to this bill. Bamato said despite the support, it will be a challenge for New York to pass it during the state's current legislative session, which ends this Thursday, June 12th. Yeah, I'm wondering, where does New York as a state on a policy level stand in terms of protecting immigrant communities in the United States, especially with the state housing one of the largest undocumented immigrant populations in particular?
New York for All and Digging That Detention, these are bills that states like California passed 5 years ago and Illinois passed 4 years ago. So we're going at the rate right now of New Mexico. New Mexico has this legislation. We are way behind and we have a lot of catching up to do. Unfortunately, I've seen that any good bill in the New York State legislature takes about 10 years to pass, and that should not be. That should not be at all. Just a bureaucracy, and it almost has to be a perfect storm for something important to pass. And I can't think of a bigger storm and than right now to pass these kinds of legislation. So with that being said, we'll continue to fight because it just needs to happen. But it's also up to advocates to for us to come up with and try to catch up and push our legislators to catch up to the rest of the progressive states and meet them where they are.
The focus on ending immigrant detention is usually centered on private detention facilities, such as those run by CoreCivic and the GEO Group. Salma Cisse, a staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, who specializes in discriminatory immigration policies, said that New York is an interesting case as the state actually banned private prisons back in 2007. Cisse explained the emergence of counties as a particular point of concern partially stems from the fact that because ICE cannot work with private contractors in New York, counties provide them with another means for detention.
Seeing a lot of focus on private detention. So a lot of places are trying to reduce private detention, to ban private detention. For instance, New York State has actually banned private detention facilities in the state, right? And so there's a huge movement against private detention, and most ICE detention centers are private detention centers that are ran by corporations like GEO Group or Civic or things like that. And so the county contracts provide them another avenue to try and increase detention without having to, you know, deal with the issues around private contractors.
Immigration detention as a whole has been expanding, specifically as a system of criminalization against immigrants in the United States over the last decades, Cisse said. But this increase in demand has been met with a limited supply of federal beds to detain immigrants in, leading ICE to work with local county jails where beds are more available and pay these counties per bed per night to function as detention centers. My question is, why do counties enter into these types of contracts with ICE in the first place?
Immigration detention has been expanding over the past few years. Immigration detention used to be really rare. It used to be something that was reserved for individuals who were considered extremely dangerous or who were considered individuals who would not return to their immigration hearing. But over the past few years, we've seen immigration detention become the norm. So anyone who is in removal proceedings, anyone who the government is trying to deport, they will try to detain them. And they just don't have enough federal beds for that. There are not enough immigration detention centers around the country to house everyone that DHS and Immigration Customs Enforcement are trying to detain during their immigration hearing. And so they developed this contract plan where they essentially throughout the country go to local county jails. So these are oftentimes jails where people are first held when they're arrested for criminal charges as they go through arraignment and other things. And they usually have beds in these low county jails because they're not long, they're not places of long-term incarceration. People are usually there for a year maximum, but much, much shorter times. And so they approached these local counties, oftentimes knowing that these counties are sympathetic to what ICE is trying to do in terms of targeting specific populations. And they offer them money. You know, they say, you have empty beds. We can enter this contract with you. They pay counties per bed per night. And it's a source of revenue for the counties. It's a source of signaling of values oftentimes for these counties, especially if they have a sheriff that's extremely conservative or more anti-immigrant in their rhetoric and how they go about viewing law enforcement. And so these contracts have existed for years. And unfortunately, we've seen efforts by ICE to really try and expand their contracting ability.
ICE has several contracts with counties in New York, including Clinton, Nassau, Rensselaer, Broome, and Orange, with the biggest one being with Orange County. The Orange County Jail has already been under significant controversy for its inhumane conditions and abusive treatment towards its immigrant detainees. In 2023, the Center for Constitutional Rights, alongside legal nonprofit Bronx Defenders and the New York Civil Liberties Union, had actually sued Orange County and ICE for its human rights violations, specifically in regards to the jail's response to a mass hunger strike led by immigrants within the facility back in 2021.
This is during the height of the COVID-19 crisis, and people were speaking out around conditions in the jail, lack of adequate food, terrible medical access to medical care, racism and violence from guards. And in retaliation for speaking to media, for speaking to advocates about what they had experienced, the county placed a lot of these individuals in solitary or like segregated units. They gave them disciplinary tickets, which essentially goes on their records and creates issues for them later on down the line. And then later on transferred about 27 or more people. That number may not actually be accurate, but a large number of people to southern detention centers in Louisiana and Mississippi to try and break up the hunger strike and the organizing that was happening on the inside.
The lawsuit continues into 2025 as they prepare for trial. With the recent influx of ICE agents arresting people in New York, Matos said many of those arrested are being actively brought to Orange County.
I was wondering if you could kind of go into the relationship between the Orange County Jail in particular with ICE and the role the facility has historically and currently plays in detaining immigrants in New York.
Yes, at the time that we're talking and discussing and during this interview, there is a surge of ICE agents arresting people across New York State and the country. And Orange County, being the county with the biggest contract with ICE at the moment, holds a big role because we are seeing people being sent to Orange County, as well as other facilities across New Jersey. And we know and understand that ICE detention should not exist. I've heard it be called hell on earth by people detained, and they rather be deported or call out the abuses. And these are folks that are just everyday people trying to live their lives. And unfortunately, they rather be deported than live through another few days, few months of being detained.
Alongside ICE, the other defendants in the lawsuit named include current sheriff of Orange County, Paul Arteta, alongside former sheriff Carl DuBois and former undersheriff Kenneth Jones, who's also a member of the far-right militia group the Oath Keepers during his tenure as undersheriff. The latter two have since come out denying the allegations of abuse outlined in the lawsuit. Cisse argues that the contract Orange County has with ICE not only serves as a source of profit, but as a signaling of values in favor of them.
Orange County is so important to the discussion around ICE contracts in New York State is that they are one of the locations that, you know, when I was talking about before, like sort of like these contracts as a signaling of values that have really stuck their or dug their foot in and said that they believe in these contracts because the sheriff, the former sheriff, I mean, the current sheriff doesn't talk about it so much, but the former county sheriff was extremely anti-immigrant and would say regularly make very racist comments about immigrants and really showed the reason why he thought this was so important. And that correlated to the treatment of people who were detained at Orange County.
However, despite its active collaboration with ICE, Orange County was one of the New York counties the Department of Homeland Security recently deemed a sanctuary jurisdiction that was violating federal immigration law on a list they published on May 30th and have since taken down in the face of public backlash over its inaccuracy. Outside addressing the issue of detention, Cisse said that the Dignity Not Detention Act also curbs enforcement. In addition to harming those physically detained, detention facilities often negatively impact the surrounding community or the very community that they're built in. And I was wondering if you could kind of expand on that negative impact.
For the immigrant populations who are living in those cities where these facilities are located, there's just rampant racial profiling because there is incentive for police to cooperate with ICE because they know that their bed's really close by for people to be detained. So we have the saying, like, if they build it and it's close, they will fill it. And especially with these types of contracts where people are being paid or counties are being paid per bed, there is an incentive to keep the beds filled. You know, we have been telling all legislators that we talk to is that when you reduce the beds, you reduce enforcement.
The Dignity Not Detention Act is often presented in tandem with the New York For All Act, which bars any state and local government employee, including the police, from collaborating with ICE, whether it's by disclosing personal information or diverting resources to aid federal immigration enforcement. This comes after the Broome County Sheriff's Office and the Nassau County Sheriff's Office and Police Department signed explicit agreements in March to cooperate with ICE. Although a major mission has been to pass these two pieces of legislation, Macho said they don't have the luxury of waiting until they pass and will continue to organize as they have been doing.
You mentioned before about how with the Orange County Jail in particular, you've done organizing with the community surrounding the facility. I was wondering if you could kind of go more into that organizing and what you've done or are trying to do with those communities.
We've done legal clinics at the facility. We were able to touch base with lots of folks, the immigrant community that lives there and feels the everyday brunt of having to be afraid to walk out their house, to send their kids to school, go work. In the last few months, we've had the most amount of legislators sign on to this bill. So there is a lot of interest in passing this bill. Unfortunately, we're not getting the signals from the governor's office that this legislation will pass this year. I think they're being pretty precautious, but we can't wait. We can't wait for more facilities to open across New York State. And so we are one, continuing to push leadership and lobby in Albany and lobby at the local level and to come together as a state and organize ourselves in a better way. Because it's not just about passing the legislation. It's about fighting for immigrant rights and human respect and human dignity.
In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, there's some good news, hopeful news, in Sullivan County's opioid crisis, but the work isn't over. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar explains next. This is Radio Catskill.
This week on This American Life, we visit a hospital in Africa, complete with beautiful operating rooms and flying drones that carry snakebite antivenom that treated a big chunk of its country's people for absolutely free. In February, their funding was shut down when the Trump administration closed USAID. And now the people running this hospital are pondering what was good and what was bad about what they built here.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sullivan County has shown some progress in the fight against the opioid epidemic. Overdose death rates have shown a gradual decline in recent years, but health officials and local residents say now is not the time to dial back. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar attended Sullivan County's Substance Use Task Force meeting at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center recently. The task force is a county-led effort to coordinate substance use prevention and treatment strategies. And she brings us this report.
Dorothy Sanchez can never forget the day her son Jonathan died from an overdose.
Law enforcement, I don't know how many times you saved my son's life, but he died. And he died from an overdose. And I have insights that I think you guys need to know.
Jonathan was 33 years old when he died last September. Sanchez is one of more than 25 community members who joined Monday's public meeting for Sullivan County's Substance Use Task Force. It's a county-led effort with community partners, health officials, and law enforcement to improve the lives of those impacted by substance use. County data shows that opioid overdose deaths in Sullivan County have declined. At a June 5th legislature meeting, County Coroner Albie Bachman said that for the first time in his 10 years as coroner, there were no overdose deaths in Sullivan County during the month of May. That's largely in part due to efforts like expanding Narcan availability and tightening the drug supply flow, according to county officials. But Sanchez said that the current solutions aren't enough.
I saw him die with all of the efforts that we're doing, but we're in a hamster wheel trying to catch them and save their lives because we don't have an alternative. When we give them Narcan, then what? Then they walk out the door and they get high again. And that's what he kept doing. And it was over and over again. So the concern is not that none of this should be eliminated. We're working really hard, but we have to go to another step.
At the June 9th meeting, health experts discussed what they know, what's working, and further plans to address addiction. Heather Guinan is a nurse practitioner who's part of the task force. She said that intergenerational cycles of substance use have become increasingly visible.
When you think back, the height of the opioid prescribing was around 2009, 2010. So then you look ahead now, 15 years after that, you're going to see those children of maybe parents that were using or prescribed. One of the ways that they often, what I hear is that they often got into using was from the medicine cabinet at home, or access was very, you know, it was very liberal. There was a lot of opioids around.
Guinan also said that healthcare providers are seeing an increase in infectious diseases amongst patients with substance use issues.
We are seeing more cases of syphilis in the community. Also, we have the continued high prevalence of hepatitis C. And also a new thing is we're seeing an increase in positive QFT tests, which is an indication that someone has been exposed to an individual with active tuberculosis. So no, we're not necessarily seeing active tuberculosis cases, but we're seeing indicators that that are showing us that people are walking around amongst, you know, the general population with tuberculosis, and other people are being exposed to that.
So what strategies are working? Sullivan County Commissioner John Little said that building a network and new technology that allows different organizations to share information has been key.
So what this network does is it securely shares client information. The network is HIPAA and 42 CFR Part 2 compliant, which I know is a big deal for those in the substance use treatment community. but what's really phenomenal about it is it's not just a way to get a referral to a doc. It's a referral to get to any of these different types of services, nutrition services, housing services, and so on and so forth.
Opioid settlement funds have also given the county more funding to help support addiction services. This is money received by New York State from settlements with companies that contributed to the opioid epidemic. In Sullivan County, Commissioner Little says funding has gone towards school prevention programs, peer services, and even homes.
Something I'm definitely very excited about is the $200,000 recently approved for sober living homes provided via Oxford House. So that is a reality that is moving forward.
But all unrestricted dollars from the opioid settlement funds, roughly $100,000, for the last 3 years went entirely to law enforcement. Commissioner Little said this investment is necessary for efforts that don't squarely fall into recovery programs.
When you talk about tools for law enforcement, which we in the task force believe are very important, for example, software that the district attorney's office and the sheriff's office use to exploit captured cell phones to find information about drug dealers, that's the kind of thing that money is going to. What we're seeing is that those specific law enforcement tools are helping us get at the supply side. And then on the treatment, on the prevention side, we're working on the demand side as well. And that's really been Sullivan County's approach to this from when we started this in 2021, was you have to work all aspects of the problem. It can't just be a war on drugs. It can't just be only treatment. We have to work every possible angle to reduce the impact of drugs on our community.
Liberty Police Chief Steve Tagata, who co-leads the law enforcement pillar of the task force, said law enforcement programs are key to tackling the opioid epidemic. Their Hope Not Handcuffs program is one initiative that local officials are excited about. According to Tagata, police officers help divert individuals who would be placed in the criminal justice system and into treatment when appropriate.
The key to Hope Not Handcuffs' success, in my opinion, has been leveraging the thousands of touch points that law enforcement has with individuals experiencing substance use disorder. For this population of individuals that we're all in this room and many other rooms throughout the year working together to try and help, the government official that they most often and frequently come into personal contact with is law enforcement. Prior to deflection initiatives like Hope Not Handcuffs, those interactions resulted in one of three things: nothing being done, the individual being taken to an emergency room, or the individual being taken to jail. So the hope of deflection practices and our partnership with Hope Not Handcuffs is to leverage all of those touch points to connect people when they're willing to treatment.
Little added that right now the county is referring all individuals that need inpatient services out of county, but not for long. Lexington Center for Recovery plans to open an inpatient facility at Garnet Health Catskill Harris this fall. But Dorothy Sanchez, whose son passed last year, said Sullivan County needs to step up.
maintaining people in addiction is not okay. My son was on methadone for many, many years with Narcan in his pocket, with, in his book bag, because they all have book bags, with an overdose with Narcan on methadone and still overdose while in drug court. It doesn't work.
Little says that he and his team are trying to bring as many strategies to the table, but
at the same time, we also feel handcuffed in a lot of ways.
I know. I understand.
We see that, unfortunately, substance use treatment, like a lot of healthcare in this country, you know, it's like one out of every $5 or $6 spent in this country right now. It's a business. And the business is there to preserve the business, not necessarily the customer. It's unfortunate. But this is why we're here.
Camille O'Brien, Substance Use Task Force Coordinator, says that while overdose numbers have shown a downward decline, now is not the time to slow down.
We don't want to take the foot off the gas. As long as there's still any numbers on the board, we want to keep moving forward. And I think we're just figuring out new ways because every case is different. So the quick response team is a new way. Again, with the Fatality Review Board, hopefully we'll come up with some new strategies because not every strategy works on everybody. Just like there's so many different types of recovery and recovery programs. We just keep moving forward and keep getting more and more input. And, you know, some people use the term hamster wheel. It can feel like that, but when you start seeing people that you're actually helping and seeing people get, you know, a few months and a few years of recovery, it's nothing like it.
In Hurleyville, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Randy Bannon joins us to talk about how VIP is helping survivors of domestic and sexual violence and how you can support their life-saving work. This is Radio Catskill.
Papa don't take no mess next time on Jazz Night in America as we celebrate Father's Day. We'll hear music and stories from Catherine Russell, Corey Wong, Madison and Bobby McFerrin, and more. That's coming up on Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org and from listeners like you.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Rates of domestic violence, sexual assault, and abuse remain a serious concern across the region, and local organizations like Victims Intervention Program are working around the clock to provide life-saving support and resources to those in crisis. Based in Northeast PA, VIP offers free and confidential services to survivors while also working to raise awareness and prevent violence in the community. Joining us today, Randy Bannon, Executive Director from VIP, to talk about the services they provide, some challenges they're facing, and how people can seek help or get involved. Randy, welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
And thank you for being here. Can you just explain a little bit more about some of those services that VIP offers to individuals in crisis or in need of support?
Sure. So we are a community-based program. And like you had mentioned, we work with victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and other forms of interpersonal violence. We have crisis intervention and safety planning. We provide advocacy for the clients we're working with. We have counseling services, emotional support. We also provide shelter and emergency housing. We have legal advocacy, legal support, and referrals. We do many community education programs and prevention programs within the schools. And then we're always looking at system changes.
What are some of the most pressing challenges your organization is facing right now?
Always serving survivors. We're always trying to make sure that we have all the appropriate funds available to serve the multifaceted needs of people who are fleeing domestic violence or who have experienced trauma, because it is, you know, it can be a very deep issue, and we want to make sure that we have all the funds and resources to support them throughout their entire journey.
Are there some common myths or misunderstandings about victims or the kind of help your program provides? And can you just, you know, demystify some of that for folks?
Sure. Oftentimes we hear from community members that if there wasn't physical violence, it's not domestic violence. And that's one of the myths about domestic violence. We recognize that there are multiple aspects of power and control in an intimate partner relationship that often involves, intimidation tactics, using the children, financial abuse, legal abuse, coupled with physical violence and sexual violence. So oftentimes, if there isn't that physical aspect, she wasn't hit, or she didn't get, she wasn't punched or hurt, or some physicality, the domestic violence isn't seen, because oftentimes people, if you can't see it, then it doesn't exist.
And, we talked to you during, months like Domestic Awareness Month, the Sexual mm-hmm. Violence Month, but it's always important to talk to you at all times. So again, let's remind folks about what are some of the early red flags or warning signs of abuse that people often overlook.
Right. So some, it can be a slow progression. It isn't always, it usually escalates to the physical violence, but there's isolation. Somebody who maybe isn't allowed to work, doesn't have access to their own money, isn't allowed to have a vehicle. The abusive partner always having to accompany them to everything, and be involved in every phone call. Isolation from family. So, that partner intercepting phone calls, not wanting them to be alone with family. Those are a lot of red flags that, family members may experience, but missing work, unexplained bruises, withdrawn, so those are some aspects of domestic violence, but trauma in general too. I mean, you can really see people who are withdrawn or, lack interest in activities, things that they usually like to do, being around friends, being around family, especially if it was typical of their behavior. So any drastic changes in behavior, could signify that something's going on.
Talk a little bit more about someone who feels trapped or closely monitored like that. What are some safe ways for someone like that to reach out for help?
That's a wonderful question, because it's challenging, and COVID really, during those times that really kind of entrenched that being cut off. But ways of reaching out, we do have our text chat line, which I think is great and can be accessed through our website. So anybody who, has access to the internet can chat via our text chat information. We have the 24-hour crisis hotline. So if the abusive party maybe works overnight or works on the weekends, times when businesses are typically closed, we're available. So making sure that we're getting the word out there so people know about that. We have wonderful partnerships with the hospital, with schools, with other social service agencies. And those partnerships look like, if a person were to take their child for a routine medical appointment and they wanted us to meet them at the doctor's appointment, that seems like, that wouldn't raise any red flags necessarily, because the person's, meeting them at the doctor, and we can maybe pop in and just get our information out there. Plus, we have a wonderful partnership with the hospital. They call us over for, many, many things that they see as well.
What is that phone number? Let's remind folks that phone number or text line where folks can get in touch with you, or if someone suspects a friend or a loved one's being abused.
Sure, 570-253-4401, and that's a text and the chat, as well as our hotline, our 24-hour crisis hotline number.
You mentioned some of the community support that you get. How can the broader community get involved or support VIP's mission?
Yeah, so we're always looking for volunteers. Right now, we are looking for new board members. We really want to build a robust board. It is a very active board. So we are looking for community partners throughout Wayne and Pike County, for people who are interested in joining that way. We also have volunteers who are well-trained by our program and who run our hotline, who can be available on those evenings and those weekends to take calls from survivors, or, meeting them at the hospital or assisting them to get into shelter. So there's those ways of volunteering.
And are there other events or fundraisers or way for folks to just show their support that are coming up that you want folks to know about?
Yes. So our third annual golf tournament is coming up, and I'm excited to say our third annual because it's something that has now been living on and has been growing, and the board is doing a great job getting it underway. So that's August 22nd at the Honesdale Country Club. And it's an all day event that we expect to be, fun, a fun day in the sun. There'll be raffles, there'll be food. And we're hoping to see some familiar faces.
And again, before we go, let's remind folks about that hotline and how folks can get in touch if they need support or advice from VIP.
Yes, 570-253-4401.
That's Randy Bannon, Executive Director from VIP Victims Intervention Program in Northeast Pennsylvania. They offer free and confidential services to survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and abuse. And for folks who may know someone as well, they're there to help raise awareness and prevent violence in the community. Randy, thank you for joining us, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for letting us get our message out there.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Radio Catskills' Julia Kim speaks with drag icon Mrs. Kasha Davis about why the weekend Drag Me to the Catskills event is both a party and a powerful statement. You're listening to Radio Catskills.
Hi, it's Mimi. Last week, the White House asked Congress to claw back funds that were already approved for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Nearly a quarter of Radio Catskill's funding comes from the CPB. Its loss threatens local and national programs that our listeners rely on. Urge Congress to vote against rescinding public media funding. Find out how at protectmypublicmedia.org. That's protectmypublicmedia.org. Thank you.
On this Old House Radio Hour, cleaning guru Brandon Plaschek shares his best-kept secrets for spotless surfaces and DIY cleaning potions.
One tool that I would say is like a massive game changer and I recommend pretty much to anyone is a drill brush scrubber.
Plus, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal thought he had found a perfect post-divorce retreat. Instead, he wound up with the house from hell. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Join us for This Old House Radio Hour from 8 p.m.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Forestburg Playhouse in the Sullivan Catskills is hosting its second Drag Me to the Catskills weekend-long series of events this weekend, focusing on celebrating drag performance, featuring a renowned cast of drag queens who have been critical to the modern drag movement and drag's rise in pop culture through shows like RuPaul's Drag Race. Drag Me to the Catskills aims to bring this powerful form of LGBTQ+ expression directly to Sullivan County for Pride Month. Radio Catskills' Julia Kim spoke with Forestburg Playhouse director Franklin Trapp about what the event has in store for audiences and with drag queen Mrs. Kasha Davis on the importance of drag to both her own life and to that of others, especially amid the federal government's increasing hostility towards the LGBTQ+ community. Here's Franklin.
I mean, the Playhouse has a long history of hosting drag performers and queer-themed events, so this is nothing new to us. But we are fortunate enough to do an entire weekend of events, thanks to the support of the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association as a weekend sponsor. So thanks to them and our collaboration with Drag Me to the Stage, which brings in all the queens, we're able to do a full weekend of it, giving our patrons and also visitors to the area an opportunity to pick and choose what they'd like to do, or spend a whole weekend and get to know the beautiful area in which we live.
Yeah, so Drag Me to the Catskills obviously features a very powerful selection of drag queens. You mentioned, I mean, so many of them are household names. They've been on hit shows like RuPaul's Drag Race, and you kind of mentioned how that came out of partnering with Drag Me to the Stage. But yeah, I was wondering if you could kind of go into that process. How did the Tavern kind of decide on incorporate the cast of drag performers?
We worked with Drag Me to the Stage and the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association to do the first annual Drag Me to the Catskills weekend. And during that weekend, we did a couple performances. It wasn't as much as we're doing this year. So thanks to the success of last year's events, we've amped it up, we've expanded it, and we're really excited to share it with our friends and neighbors and visitors.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could kind of go into the drag scene within like the Sullivan Catskills area, as I think the queer community is often associated with major cities, like obviously New York City. But yeah, I was wondering if you kind of go into...
Well, honey, the scene is at the Forestburg Playhouse. In the Sullivan Catskills, we have a very diverse community up here because we are so close to New York City, just 90 plus miles away. There are wonderful organizations that support LGBTQ plus programming like Catskills Pride or Triversity. And there are a number of drag performers that will come to local events and perform all over the county and in the region. So there is a really exciting and vibrant scene up here. But I would say that at the Forestburg Playhouse is where we bring in events every year for years. And we also collaborate with these organizations to create a welcoming environment for the queer community and also for allies and friends and everyone. This is a really inclusive and welcoming place, and providing great entertainment is a big part of it.
So talking about those events, like for Drag Me the Catskills, you have a comedy night led by the drag queens to a festival dedicated to drag performance. And with that, there's kind of a strong emphasis on laughter and joy. So why was it important for you to center those emotions? And in your own words on the website, quote, LGBTQ plus self-pride and expression when it came to these events?
I mean, it's something that... you know, as the artistic director of the Playhouse, I've always believed in those things that you just mentioned. And that's always been a major part of the programming that I've planned here at the Playhouse. But I think now even more than ever, showing these types of events and celebrating Pride Month, celebrating LGBTQ plus community, it is more important than ever because of the world that we live in. We need to be proud and we need to be strong. And the only way you can do that is by coming together and knowing that there's a community and a sense of ourselves as individuals and as a community. That's how we can accomplish change in a time where change may seem impossible.
Just how does it feel to celebrate the queer community amidst this kind of country's increasingly oppressive climate towards queer people, especially with drag queens in particular being a major target of conservative backlash?
To be honest, that's why we're doing this. We need to highlight it. We need to broadcast it. We need to empower these artists, and we need to pay them. The only way that they can do the work that they do is by working. And drag in and of itself as an art form is subversive in nature. And if we lose that subversive voice, then we will be losing ground to the terrible decisions that are being made.
Kind of going to one of your events in particular, you mentioned you're hosting Wigstock in the Catskills, which pays, you know, direct homage to the historic Wigstock Drag Festival in New York City's Tompkins Square Park that was organized by Lady Bunny, one of your featured performers from 1985 until about 2000. And like, why was it important for you to kind of continue maintaining the legacy of Wigstock and bringing it directly to the Catskills?
Well, it has been hiatus for a bit. I think the tie-in of Wigstock, obviously to the New York City, in New York City, it was Wigstock wasn't just a party. It also was addressing the AIDS crisis in the United States. So it's kind of like a pride festival as well. Wigstock was a very important, coming together for the community. But it also has a fun tie-in with the Woodstock concert, which happened up here in Sullivan County, just miles away from the Playhouse in 1969, I believe. So that's having a drag version of Woodstock happening on our stage and, you know, tying us into Pride Month and also with a connection to the music legacy in our area is an incredible thing.
That was Franklin Trapp, director of the Forestburg Playhouse in the Sullivan Catskills. Radio Catskill also chatted with Mrs. Kasha Davis, a longtime drag queen based in Rochester, New York, who is co-owner of Drag Me to the Stage and will be performing in Drag Me to the Catskills. Since competing on Season 7 of RuPaul's Drag Race, she has been teaching at SUNY Brockport as an adjunct professor on a course dedicated to the study of drag and is behind multiple children's books and TV shows. Mrs. Kasha Davis, international celebrity housewife, you know, known for dad jokes. But yeah, I was wondering if you could kind of go more into the process of developing or coming into this specific persona.
It means the world to me because for two reasons. One, when I was a child, I was encouraged to actually suppress my femininity. And I was told that that was not acceptable. And so as Mrs. Kasha Davis, I get to be all of my gender. And that is, you know, I live as Ed, he, him. I perform as Kasha, she, her. And then when I do comedy, my pronouns are he, he. But there's the dad joke. So, but that is number one. And then number two, when I first started and created the character of Mrs. Kasha Davis, it was a time before marriage equality. And I wanted to put that out into the world that, yes, it's possible for there to be same-sex relationships that are, you know, marriage-worthy. And my husband and I had our spiritual marriage, and then we had our legal marriage. And at this point now, it's 22 years that we've been together. And so that was important to me. And I couldn't even believe that it actually became legal when it did. So probably in your lifetime, it's always been legal. Or from as far back as you can at least remember. So that was a big part of the character. And I get to give a nod to those people in my family and keep them alive. You know, my mom's in heaven and I always like to talk about her when I do drag because I feel like she's with me. She was that fancy lady who taught me all this.
You know, the Forest Brook Tavern Playhouse is partnering with Drag Me to the Stage, which you are co-owner of. And I wonder if you could go into what Drag Me to the Stage is and aims to do and why you have led this kind of initiative.
Well, it's been, you know, I've been producing shows with my husband for years and some of the other queens. And then Tim Evanecki came onto the scene. And this is somebody he's had theater experience and touring experience. And he and his husband approached and said, let's join forces. Let's join talents. And now we're bringing on, you know, massive RuPaul's Drag Race stars to participate in, you know, drag brunches and bingos and evening shows and whatever the case may be.
I mean, obviously you are very integral to the drag community, but you've also like been able to work with like amazing drag queens. How, you know, does it feel to be able to kind of take on a more collaborative approach, I guess, to drag? Or has that always been kind of an essence of it?
Each of us have our own talents. I mean, Thorgy Thor is a concert violinist, right? So to be able to do a show with Thorgy, I mean, I don't play any instruments, but to bring Thorgy on stage and they do that, and then I bring my part and we all come together. And it's just this wonderful melting pot of fabulosity.
I want to ask, you know, what drag more broadly kind of means to you, because with your drag in particular, you've been very much open about your experiences growing up gay in Pennsylvania, where it isn't necessarily the most welcoming environment, and then your own journey with sobriety. And those are just aspects of your experience that you have actively incorporated into your practice and performance as a drag queen.
Honesty is important. There was a time back in Hollywood where, you know, you weren't allowed to come out. You would never be successful. And this wasn't even that long ago. So now today, I think it's so important to do that, because the more we are ourselves, we are being authentic, we are being honest. I do, as you mentioned, I talk about my sobriety, not to brag about it, but in case someone is struggling in the world and thinking, can I live without drugs and alcohol? Yes, you can. And you can be successful and be fantastic. Does that mean that everybody should stop drinking? Of course not. Of course not. But when it becomes an issue for people, I like to be a source of somebody who is working on it and is saying like, oh my gosh, this is possible for me too. So to me, drag in general is a platform where I can talk about these things honestly. And drag is always a bit of a protest. And I will finally say that all drag is good. Good drag is great. Bad drag is even better. You know, so it's like, you know, get out there and just express yourself.
I think what's interesting is we are seeing this kind of more mainstream integration of drag queens through RuPaul's Drag Race, which you were a part of. But at the same time, we're also kind of seeing right now this increase in hostility towards the queer community on a governmental level. So it's kind of like this double-sided visibility where, you know, drag queens have been and continue to be really a huge part of pop culture, yet also being a target of, you know, homophobic and transphobic rhetoric. And so I was just wondering how you've had to navigate this kind of increasing hostility, you know, as a drag queen yourself.
Fortunate enough to have a third semester of teaching a drag class, drag theory, culture, and performance at SUNY Brockport. And in my discovery, in my preparation for the class, I also have learned that drag has always existed, that trans has always existed, this spectrum. And there have been times in history where people are celebrated and then persecuted. And we go through this sort of pendulum in history. And I think it's important right now for people to not only be expressing themselves, but for our allies to be supportive of people who might be different. I think that more and more people gathering together to support shows people who might be watching from home, who might be wandering on the street and not a part of a protest, to say, okay, I'm not alone. I'm going to be okay. And I think that that's really important to remember, is that this isn't really anything new. It's just, it's heightened right now. And we will continue, and we will not be erased, and we will always be here. And frankly, I think people are having a lot more fun than ever. When I was a kid, I was telling my niece, there was a time when if you wore an earring, and if you, as a male, if I wore an earring in the wrong ear, I could get beaten up. And now we have people having, you know, men having long hair and painted fingernails. I mean, we really are making a lot of progress. And it's ruffling some feathers of conservative people. You know what? Let's ruffle them. Because it's their fear that is coming forward. They disguise their fear with anger, because that's easier and fiery. But what they are is they're scared to take a look at themselves.
That was Mrs. Kasha Davis. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
And that's going to be the end of this edition of Radio Chatskill. But before we go, we've been telling you about the potential loss of funding at the federal level for Radio Catskill and other public media. And we're urging you to contact your House representative today about that potential elimination of federal funding through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that helps bring you unique and trusted daily local news like this show and the local edition and all of our reporting, plus all of our programming. It's under threat of elimination. On May 28th, the administration proposed a rescission package to Congress that would claw back previously appropriated CPB funding for all public media stations, including Radio Catskill, in fiscal year 26 and 27. It's already been approved. The House is expected to vote on Trump's rescissions package this afternoon, and today's vote will be close. If you have not already communicated to your lawmaker what the impact of rescission would be to you and your community, please do so immediately so they can understand how their vote will affect you and their constituents' access to trusted local news, educational programming, life-saving emergency alerts, and non-commercial music that brings all of our communities together. Go to protectmypublicmedia.org and make your voice heard. That's protectmypublicmedia.org, or you can access that link at our website, wjffradio.org. Do it today. They're voting this afternoon, and you can help save Radio Catskill and public media. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected. Primary election day in New York is June 24th. June 14th is the deadline to register to vote and to apply for mail-in or absentee ballot, online or by mail. June 23rd is the last day to apply in person for a mail-in or absentee ballot. Ballots must be postmarked by June 24th and received by the Board of Elections that same day. Early voting is June 14th to 22nd. Polls are open on primary election day from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, mostly sunny and 77. There is an air quality alert in effect until midnight tonight. When pollution levels are elevated, the New York State Department of Health recommends individuals consider limiting strenuous outdoor physical activity to reduce the risk of adverse health effects. People who may be especially sensitive are folks with pre-existing respiratory problems such as asthma or heart disease and the very young. Tonight, partly cloudy, 54. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies in the early morning hours, a few showers developing later in the day with a high of 72, 56 for a low Friday night. And looking ahead to the weekend, overcast 66, Saturday 66 and a few showers early on Sunday, otherwise overcast as well. On Point is next.